So today is December 7th, if I'm not mistaken. And we are in our second to last class. I'll get them out. The second to last class in the book of Job. And indeed, perhaps the first thing I should do is the handouts. So this week's handout looks exactly like last week's handout. The first page is exactly the same. But I made changes in the pages that come afterwards. So don't get confused. Put aside the old handout and use today's handout. Now, if anyone didn't get today's handout, I made 16 copies. There are certainly enough.
Thank you.
And I put them out on the tables. I have only one left in my hand, so they're all down there. Now, no one needs? Okay, so there's one extra. So let's just do a one-minute review of the whole book of Job. Okay, to make a long story short, we see in the prologue that Job, in point of fact, did not sin. He's a great man. He's a righteous man. And then he becomes tremendously ill after he loses all his possessions and all his family and all his children. The worst things happen to him. But Job does not complain. Then we get to chapter 3. And his friends come to comfort him. They see the terrible situation that he is in, physically, mentally, spiritually, lost everything. He's down on his luck. He doesn't know what to do. And the way they console him is by basically telling him, it's God's justice, you must have done something wrong, even though we don't know what it is. And Job says, but I didn't do anything wrong. I did my best. I was a righteous person. I never had a weak moment in my life. And we know that that's true from the beginning of the book. But they say there must be something you didn't know about. It was hidden. There can't be a man on earth that didn't sin. So he says, may God appear and tell me what I did wrong. Please, let bring me to trial. I'll defend myself. But then he said, God must be a monster. God would never tell me why he's doing this to me. God would bring me to trial and then purposely trip me up. God is a corrupt DA who's only trying to get me. Job wants to know why this is happening. And he feels that God is terribly oppressing him. God is not acting like God. And he wants to know what he did wrong. And then at the end of the book, chapter 38, God appears to Job. And you know what? God does not tell him that he did wrong. And certainly doesn't tell him what he did wrong. And in that sense, it looks like the end of the book indeed tells us that Job's friends were not correct. He's not being punished for something he did wrong. So what is going on? Well, God doesn't really say. God doesn't relate directly to Job's questions. Doesn't relate to what the friends said. Rather, what God does and God says basically reminds me of a visit I had to the New York Planetarium many years ago. And I'm sitting there in the planetarium in this chair, and they're showing you a movie of the cosmos, and it's if you're going in a spaceship deeper and deeper into the cosmos, and the planets are flying by, and they're flying by faster and faster and faster, and you never get to the end. There's more and there's more and there's more and there's more and there's more, and you see, it's so big, it's so vast, and I am absolutely, positively nothing. I'm less than a speck of dust in that whole grand tapestry of the cosmos. That's basically what God says to Job at the end of the book. He says, look at this world. Look how much there is there. And who are you in the grand scheme of things? And then God takes him on a overflight of the Amazon. And he shows him the animals there. And he shows him the fantastic power and intricacy and related connections and seeming lack of rationality in the violent yet beautiful animal kingdom. And the effect is the same. God is saying to Job, just look at all of this. What's supposed to come of all of this? Well, God doesn't say. But it looks like the impression is, as Robert Alter told us in the sheets we read last week, Job, understand that there's more to life than you. There's more to this world than you. God doesn't have to give you an accounting of what's going on. It's not that God is saying, Job, you sinned, but you can't understand why you deserve to be punished for it. No, it's not about sin at all. Now, that's not a full answer. We still ask, but why is he suffering? But the effect is to say, don't focus on all your energies on asking. There are larger things that God has in mind than trying to adopt perhaps God's perspective. Everything is so vast and you're just a speck of dirt. Not a philanthropist at all, but a whole different perspective. And what I want to do today is to see a number of fascinating sources from the Talmud and from Jewish literature that shed light on different parts of what we see here in the end of the book from 38 to 41. So the first source, it's on the second side of the sheet, the first side we did last week. In this booklet, the first side is just like last week's booklet, but the rest of it is different. So it's on the back of the first sheet. There's a passage here from the Babylonian Talmud. Mimi has an extra. The Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, page 13a to 13b. And why am I bringing this source here? Because we just saw in the epilogue, in the end of the book, that God does not tell Job that he sinned. The reason for what's happening, if there is a reason, is not related to crime and punishment. Even though that's what the traditionalist friends of Job suggested and were certain, God does not vindicate the position that if bad things happen to you, it's because you're being punished. God does not vindicate that position. And this Talmudic passage goes through that same back and forth, just like we saw in the book, Eliphaz, you sinned, Job, I didn't sin, and God does not vindicate the position that says he sinned. The same type of back and forth is found in this Talmudic passage in a fascinating fashion. It is taught in the Tana Debei Eliyahu, and Tana Debei Eliyahu means the teachings of the house of Eliyahu, which is a source from before the year 200 of the Common Era, from the time of the Mishnah. And I'll later say more about the source. So in this ancient collection of teachings, it says the following. It once happened that a certain scholar who had studied much Bible and Mishnah and had served scholars much, which means he was always in the house of study, he was listening, he was participating, he was taking notes, he was repeating and going over his studies. He was a very high quality student and a very well-known rabbi. Yet he died in middle age. A tragedy. His wife took his tefillin and carried them about in the synagogues and schoolhouses, and she also came to Melton, and complained to them. It's written in the Torah, she said, for that is thy life and the length of thy days. The Torah is the length of one's life. It's the meaning of life. It's all there is. My husband, who read Bible, learned Mishnah, and now skip, because I brought the footnotes there. So skip the footnotes and go to what, in the source I took this from, is the next page, and served scholars much. Why did he die in middle age? And no man could answer her. It's as if what happened today. Here's someone, a woman who suffered a terrible tragedy in her life, and she's looking for answers. And she doesn't have an answer. As far as she knows, her husband was a fine, upstanding Jew, did everything he was supposed to do, and not only that, he was a great scholar, and he just suddenly passed away. What's the meaning of it? And she goes to all the rabbis of her town and of her area, and none of them can give her an answer. Now we wonder why she's taking his tefillin with her. Perhaps because in those days they didn't have any books. All the study was oral. The tefillin is the one memento she has. It's the one sign and proof that he was a man of the book, a man of study, a man of mitzvot. So she takes this as a sign of who he was and what he stood for, and no one can explain why God took him before his time. And I think it's tremendously important that all of these rabbis weren't willing to give her an answer, because we know that Jewish tradition has certain answers. They could have said, these different rabbis that she went to, he must have sinned, he must have did this, he must have did that. Those answers are available. Other rabbis have said such things, but these rabbis didn't say that. And to me, it already teaches me that Jewish tradition is not just of one color. There are different approaches. And here we see that one approach is that no answer is better than an answer that you can't prove, that you can't stand behind, that you're not comfortable with. They could have said, he must have sinned. They could have said, God took him before his time because he was such a righteous man, God didn't want to let him go bad in this world. Such an answer as that is found in other places. These rabbis couldn't say that. The rabbis could have said, he was taken to a better place in Olam Haba, the next world. There are some rabbis and other sources that say that. All these answers are found in our tradition. But in this particular source, these particular rabbis thought that no answer was better than an answer like that. To me, that's really significant. And I read that as God's answer to Job. Right? God could have justified Eliphaz, who said, you must have sinned somehow. And God could have told him, I won't even say what it could be. I don't know. But God refrains from giving an answer. And here also we see that the rabbis feel it better to say nothing than to say anything. And then it goes on. On one occasion, I was a guest at her house. Who is the I? The I is the author of this collection of Midrashim, collection of ancient sources. The I is Eliyahu. We said this is the Tana Debe Eliyahu, the teachings of the house of Eliyahu, the name, that's someone's name. So Eliyahu says that on one occasion, I was a guest at her house. And her house means this is after her husband passed away. And she related the whole story to me. She told me of how great her husband was and how much they were in love and how great of a scholar he was in the community. And she told me about his death and how she saw it to be meaningless, and she went to all the rabbis and they couldn't give an answer, couldn't explain with all their knowledge why he had to die. Said I to her, my daughter, how was he to thee in the days of thy menstruation? Why did he say that? Because he's looking for a hidden sin that no one else could have known about. The relationships between a person and his friends are known in the community. The way someone does his business affairs is known in the community. The way he prays in the synagogue, you see if he comes or he doesn't come. If he keeps Shabbat, you see. What he does in Yom Kippur, you see. What do you never see? Relationships between a man and his wife. And there are laws that govern that also. And this rabbi wants to check and see, perhaps there was something amiss, perhaps there was something wrong in this man's behavior. How did he behave towards his wife in the time that the Torah calls nidut, which means the menstruation, when it's forbidden according to the Torah to have physical contact between man and wife. And what did she say? God forbid, she rejoined, he did not touch me, even with his little finger. Ah, so Eliyahu discovers there was no sin, even bechadrei chaderim, in the bedroom where no one could see. But wait a second, Eliyahu doesn't relent. He continues asking questions, and he says, and how was he to thee in the days of white garments? Now what that means is, it's a long, long story, but to make a long story very short, in the Torah, according to the laws of the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, the prohibition of physical contact between man and woman is for 7 days. From the beginning of menstruation, and then 7 days. And then it's finished. The woman goes to immerse herself in the mikveh, and it's finished. But according to rabbinic law, there are 7 extra days. It's altogether 14 days. And after, sometimes 13 or 12, we won't get into details, because according to rabbinic law, after the end of menstruation, you have to count 7 clean days, 7 white days. So now, the rabbi is really probing. This is getting uncomfortable. And he's asking, you told me that your husband kept with you the Torah law. But what about the rabbinic law? Did you keep that also? And look what she says. She says, he ate with me, drank with me, and slept with me in bodily contact. Now that's a Hebrew phrase we're going to go back to. In Hebrew it's kiruv basar, which means nearness of flesh. And it's going to be ambiguous, as we'll see. He slept with me in bodily contact, and it did not occur to him to be intimate with me. Ah, a certain vindication. We weren't intimate, not only during the 7 days the Torah forbids, but even the seven remaining days that the rabbis forbid. We weren't intimate. Ah, but she had said there was some type of kiruv basar, there was some type of closeness of flesh. And that's also forbidden according to rabbinic decree. So then Eliyahu says, said I to her, blessed be the omnipresent for slaying him, that he did not condone on account of the Torah. Meaning, this man was a great scholar, but God got his tiny sin. Even though he had great Torah learning, God got him for what he did, because he slept with you, bikiruv basar, in nearness of flesh, during the time that it was rabbinically prohibited. So he found out the sin. Ah, God is vindicated. We know why it happened. For lo, the Torah hath said, and thou shalt not approach unto a woman as long as she is impure by uncleanliness. And the rabbis interpret that to mean, as we just said, that even during the seven additional days, there's a prohibition against not only sexual intimacy, but any type of kiruv basar, nearness of flesh. So God has been vindicated, as if to say, Eliphaz, going back to Job, Eliphaz wins. But this story's not over. There's another line that just blows your mind. When Rabbi Dimi came, Rabbi Dimi is an emissary who brings traditions from the scholars of Israel to the scholars of Babylonia, and this is in Babylonia. He said it was a broad bed. Now, what does that mean? It means, and I'll have to explain this on a number of different levels, it means that the two of them must have slept in a big bed. And even though she said they slept bikiruv basar, in nearness of flesh, she didn't mean they were touching. She meant they were near, but they weren't touching. So everything's okay. Wait a second. In the West, they said, he brings another tradition, Rabbi Isaac Rabbi Yossi said, a divider was set between them. It was even a small bed. But there was a piece of wood going through the middle of the bed, and they weren't touching each other. Now understand what just happened. It's an amazing Talmudic passage. She herself said something that could very clearly mean that there was a certain rabbinic sin here. Not only did she say that, and why distrust what she said, but that statement of hers gives us the opportunity to vindicate God's justice. And that's, of course, what we want, to understand the way things work, to vindicate God's justice. And then when everything is clear, God has been vindicated, we have answers, we can go home and sleep well at night because we know how God works, these two rabbis come and ruin it. They ruin it. And not only do they ruin it on the basis of speculation. Were they there? Did they talk to her? No. They're just saying it could be that when she said, we slept closely, it doesn't mean they actually touched. Either it was a big bed or there's a divider. Why did they say these things? They weren't there. Why did they ruin this clear answer we have to our theological dilemma? Apparently, for these two rabbis, who are great rabbis, Rabbi Dimi and Rabbi Isaac ben Yosef, it's better to have no answer than to have that answer that was suggested earlier. Because that answer doesn't make any sense to me. For that he was killed? For that one little sin? First of all, how could you be certain that that really happened, even though she said something that indicates, but perhaps you misinterpreted her words? And secondly, even if that's what they did, can you really be certain that's the way God works? And the way I read this, what happens in the very last line is exactly God in the 38th and 39th and 40th and 41st chapter of the book of Job. It's God saying, can't say anything. All those suggestions of Eliphaz and the other friends of Job, God cannot tell you that that's why he died. No answer is better than this answer. I find this so powerful. Because again, it's not just saying there's no answer. It's saying there's no answer after we have the possibility of giving an answer. And we just reject it. So we go, you can say, from clean, clear theology to messy theology. We'd rather have a messy, open-ended question that leaves us in pain than have an easy, clear, pat answer. I hope you'll always remember this passage. Now, I have something to add to it, which adds just a little wrinkle. Another exciting wrinkle. Doesn't change the things we said. which is the following. We said that this passage all comes from something called Tana Debei Eliyahu, the teachings of the house of Eliyahu. And I want to ask, has anyone ever heard of Eliyahu?
Of course.
Say it again?
Of course.
Of course. Who's Eliyahu?
Elijah.
Elijah the prophet. Right.
Yeah.
Elijah the prophet. There's a tradition that Elijah never died. There's a tradition that he comes to every circumcision, every brit milah, right? Every bris.
He's going to bring the Messiah.
Yeah. And why do we have these traditions? Because the Bible says that he went up to heaven in a
chariot.
In a chariot of storm. And he didn't die. He's always here. So there's this quasi-mystical tradition that Eliyahu didn't die. So now, when we read this passage from this collection of ancient sources called Tana Debei Eliyahu, well, it could be that this Eliyahu is simply one of the rabbis. And that's how we read the story for the past 10 minutes. But it could be that Tana Debei Eliyahu means teachings from the house of Elijah the prophet. In other words, it could be that this source is based on a belief that this is just not any old collection of writings. This is actually a prophetic writing of the house of Eliyahu the prophet. And if that's the way it's to be interpreted, let's try this out, it gets really hairy. Because it means that the prophet Eliyahu visited this poor grieving woman and asked her the questions that he asked and got the answers that he got and then said what he said. He said, God has been vindicated. We found the sin. We know why God struck down this man in middle age. If that's the way we read it, that Eliyahu said that, then how could the two rabbis at the end disagree? How could they disagree? If it was just Eliyahu the rabbi that said it, so there can be different rabbinic opinions. But if it's Elijah the prophet that said, we've now found the sin and God is to be vindicated, who are these rabbis to disagree? So I want to give an answer to the question that's found in a book that's written by the International Educational Director of Melton, Rabbi Maury Schwartz, in Jerusalem, and he's visited our framework here in Dallas a number of times. He wrote a book called Where's My Miracle, which, by the way, Rochelle said she's still selling from last year's book fair. There's a few copies available at a discounted price, but I'm not getting any royalties for it. He suggests the following. He says, look, the rabbis at the very end are perhaps exposing what Eliyahu said for what it really was. Eliyahu didn't mean to say the truth. Perhaps he just meant to say what she needed or wanted to hear. And the rabbis are saying, that's what she needed to hear, but you should know that the truth may not be so. Because again, we can't say that Eliyahu meant 100% what he said, because then how could the rabbis disagree? Perhaps the rabbis are saying he didn't really mean what he said. He didn't mean for it to be understood as complete truth. He wanted her to hear it. But we are telling you, don't take what he said as absolute truth, because it very well could be that we don't know the answer. So if we read it like that, the conclusion is everything we just said earlier. But one more thing, that perhaps sometimes there is a place to give easy theological answers to those people that need them, even if we're not sure that they're really 100% true. Which brings us to a whole nother can of worms, which is the can of worms that asks the question, do the ends always justify the means? Are you allowed to say a white lie to comfort someone who's in deep pain, and you think that an answer like that, there's a reason, can be helpful, even when you yourself don't fully embrace that reasoning?
I don't
understand why it isn't just acceptable to say that some things happen. And there's no real logical or whatever explanation. Things are beyond our control. There is a God up there directing traffic, and I'm not saying that he causes it or doesn't cause it. But some things are just unexplainable. The death of a child, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And I think sometimes we worry about trying to make excuses and answers mm-hmm. when there mm-hmm. is no answer.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
happened, mm-hmm. and that's what
yeah.
it is. I guess.
Would anyone want to answer Zona's issue? Why do we have to look for answers?
It's natural. It's part of the it's a human.
I'm sure that if we were to look in this room, some people would be comfortable with no answer, and other people would not be comfortable with no answer.
Mm-hmm. But it isn't a question of that. It's the way it is. There are no answers sometimes why things happen to people.
But not everybody.
I mean, it's what makes you comfortable is what the rabbi's saying, because my feeling on this is what a horrible thing to dump on this woman, that it was her fault that he died. So I'm looking at the whole
picture.
The whole picture of these rabbis that are, mm-hmm. but you're saying she needed to hear this.
Couldn't it be that some people might be very happy to find the reason, even if the reason is a painful reason?
Just worrying about this mystical part of life.
Because many times we blame on others. Many times we blame on others something that is going on with us. So this rabbi wanted to close the circle because she went to all synagogues and all schoolhouses. She talked to everybody. So could be this, could be that, and he just came and comprised everything to say with her. It was something...
Yeah, closure.
And close. It was nobody's fault. What if it was your fault? And that will... She won't have more questioning probably in the future.
You say won't have.
Will not.
Yeah, won't have.
Will not.
That could be closure. She could have come out of the discussion with Eliyahu feeling very, very, that's behind me.
Right.
I have an answer. My husband did something wrong. And now I can go on with my life.
But the
Again, Zona doesn't feel that way. But
the second part that you said, are we allowed to say this little white
lie?
To comfort to, I think that, wow, it's very difficult for me to answer, but I think it's, you know, it's like the psychological thing. If I say this, will stop there or will continue. If I say that, she will have happy forever and ever. You know,
slippery slope. Yeah. It's a very, very big question in general ethics and in Jewish ethics.
Yes.
The whole matter of do the ends justify the means? We could talk about that for ages, which obviously won't. Barbara?
I'm having a little bit of trouble relating this story literally to Job.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Job, if we take this literally, we know why it happened.
Right.
If we go back to the adversary. And
right. We know that Job didn't sin.
Right. So there's a reason. I mean, in the first line, almost, we know.
Yes, yeah. If we read the prologue, we know that Eliphaz is wrong. We know that there is no hidden sin. And we're almost expecting that if God does show up at the end, he's not going to say Job sinned, because we know he didn't. Indeed so. And that, again, is like the conclusion of this passage, that there might not be any hidden sin that is the reason behind the death and the tragedies that we encounter.
And it almost goes, trying to say this in a way that doesn't sound terrible, that God was playing games with Job. So not only was it not, was Job innocent, but he was really a victim.
Okay, so that goes back to the question of what does it mean that God was testing him through the adversary, and I thought I gave a nice answer to that in the first two classes. You might not accept what I said then, but we want to actually get back to that in the next class. The last class, I want to try to make the connection between the end of the book and the very beginning, which was not an easy thing to do, to see the connection between the beginning and the end. But we'll try next week. Would anyone else like to add to the discussion? I see a lot of wheels working inside just from looking from here. Okay? There's lots of more things to see in this packet. Okay. So we turn the page to a source called Avot Rabbi Natan. And I bring this source not in relationship to the disagreement between Job and Eliphaz, did Job sin? And not in light of God's statement at the end, statement of omission that Job didn't sin, but rather to focus more in God's message. Right? God's message, as we said 25 minutes ago, was the world is a bigger place than you, Job. Don't have such a Job-centered, anthropocentric focus just on you and what's happening to you. Open up your eyes to the larger perspective. And last week someone said, it might have been Barbara, that perspective that says, look at the forest and not just the trees, someone said, perhaps Barbara, that's new in the Bible. Did you know who said that? He said, we haven't seen that before. Again and again, the Bible has focused on man, on the importance of man, the centrality of man, and about thinking about why things happen and how God interacts in our lives. And suddenly the end of the book of Job has a larger, different, unique perspective that says don't focus just on man and don't focus on man's deeds and don't just focus on how God relates to man, but focus on the bigger picture. So in that context, we want to see the source of Avot Rabbi Natan. Avot Rabbi Natan can be described as a contemporaneous commentary to the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. Many of you have heard of Ethics of the Fathers. From the period of the Tanaim, the year 200 of the Common Era, 1,000 years before the Rambam. I think Rabbi Shapiro is giving a class in Melton, right, this trimester. No one's taking it, I guess. But in the first hour, I think. Or perhaps it's this hour, that's why no one's taking it. He's giving it right now. So Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, was written about 1,800 years ago, and Avot Rabbi Natan is a commentary, kind of, on Ethics of the Fathers that is contemporaneous with Ethics of the Fathers, again from 1,800 years ago. And in this book it says, Rabbi Nechemya says, from where do we know that man is equal in importance to all of creation? Then he brings verses that prove that man is equal in importance to all of creation. We don't have to read the verses. The point I want to make is that there is a rabbinic approach, an ancient approach, that says man is equal to all of creation. Man is at the pinnacle. Man is the purpose and the reason that God made everything else. The stars and the moon and the heavens and the constellations and the hippopotamuses and the giraffes, everything is here for man. And there's another source that says the same thing. In the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Brachot, Rabbi Elazar says, the Holy One, blessed be He, says, the whole world was created only for man's sake. And another source from Tractate Shabbat, Rabbi Yehuda said in Rav's name, of all that the Holy One, blessed be He, created in His world, He did not create a single thing without purpose. Everything has reason. Thus He created the snail as a remedy for a wound. You grind up the snail flesh and you put it on your burn. I've never done that, but apparently they did that. The fly is an antidote to the hornet's sting, right? Just if you get stung by a hornet, just kill a fly and put it on this thing. I've never done it, but perhaps it works. The mosquito crushed for a serpent's bite. A serpent is a remedy for an eruption, and a crushed spider as a remedy for a scorpion's bite. So you might be saying, wait a second, aren't we setting Job here? And this isn't that medicine 101. Why is he bringing this Talmudic passage? But my point is that the rabbis look around the Amazon basin and they look around the zoo and they look around the creatures that are crawling inside and outside of our houses. Everything has a purpose. But when they actually state what the purpose is, it's all for me. It's all for man. It's all for human beings. And it's part of that same philosophy that says this whole whole universe was created to serve human beings. God wanted human beings. That's why he did what he did. That's why he created the world in 6 days. He wanted... Why do you want human beings? Of course, that's a whole big question. But because he gave us free will, he gave us rationality that we can learn and grow, that's his experiment. All the other stuff, the spiders and the hippopotamuses and the stars and the moon, that's all to make the earth function so man can exist and live and experience his drama of life. Another source says the same thing. In Midrash Bereishit Rabbah, Rabbi Yeshua, Ben Rabbi Nehemiah and Rabbi Yehuda, Ben Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Lazar's name said he created him filling the whole world. That man fills the whole world. And without looking at all the verses, it is another way of saying that man's presence is what it's all about. We have the right and the responsibility to use the whole world for our needs. That's what it was created for. And we should understand our great importance in the universe. And that seems to be a pretty well-accepted approach in the Babylonian Talmud, in the ancient literature of the rabbis and of the sages. And it doesn't seem to be what Job is taught at the end of the book. Because Job seems to be taught to leave behind, to a certain degree, this perspective that it's all about us. And teach us that God has other things to deal with and think about. And we perhaps are being too egocentric in thinking that it's all about us as a species. And we wonder, will the insights of the end of the book of Job be reflected in Jewish literature? It's not so reflected in the Talmud. But bear with me for 2 more minutes, even 3, as we now go through 2 or 3 major Jewish thinkers in the Middle Ages. At the bottom of this page, I brought from Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon. Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon was one of the most important teachers of Judaism in the end of the 800s, the beginning of the 900s. He is in today what we call Iraq, in Babylonia. And he is the continuation of the Talmudic tradition, the academies, the Shivot of the Talmudic period existed for almost 1,000 years. 500 of the Common Era is the end of the Talmudic period. The rabbis that continued in the year 600, 700, 800, 900 continued at the head of those Yeshivot in Babylonia. They're called the Gaonim, Gaon. And Rabbi Sadia was one of the Gaonim, the Gaons, you would say in English. And his famous book called The Book of Beliefs and Opinions, one of the first books of Jewish philosophy written at the dawn of the Middle Ages, he writes, "When we see that the creatures are many in number, nevertheless, we need not be confused in regard to which of them constitutes the goal of creation. For there exists a natural criterion by means of which we can determine which one of all the creatures is the end, the purpose, the meaning. When then we make our investigation with this criterion as a guide, we find that the goal is man. We arrive at this conclusion the following manner. Habit and nature place whatever is most highly prized in the center of things which are themselves not so highly prized. You put your most precious possessions in the middle of the house where everyone can see them. When therefore we see that this situation appertains to many things, and find the earth in the center of heaven, with the heavenly sphere surrounding it on all sides, it becomes clear to us that the thing which was the subject of creation must be on earth." So you see here the ancient belief that the earth does not revolve around the sun, right? But that the sun revolves around the earth, that the earth is the center of the solar system. It's not even called the solar system, right? The earth system. The scientific belief in ancient times that the earth is at the center, everything revolves around it. It's not just a scientific belief, it's also a philosophical belief. You see what I'm saying here? It's part and parcel of the sense that we are the purpose of it all. And of course everything revolves around us. And I'm saying that with a double entendre. It revolves around us in a physical sense, it revolves around us in a spiritual theological sense. And that, of course, is why was it Copernicus, first came up with the idea that the Earth is not the center of the system. It wasn't only a scientific innovation, it was a theological innovation. That's why he was persecuted for it. How could you say such a thing? Because theology teaches us that man is the center of all. It's the purpose that God created. It has to be in the middle. And a scientific statement that the earth is not in the middle is akin to saying that God doesn't care about us. We're not the middle. God's concern is not upon us. That's the way it was looked at. And without even reading the whole thing, I'm afraid we won't have time, Rav Sadia Gaon, again, we're the beginning of the 900s, 1,100 years ago, is certain that the sun and the planets revolve around the earth, not just in a physical sense, but in a theological sense. The Maharal Prague, we're moving to the 13th and 14th centuries. The Maharal in the city of Prague, made famous for the mythological golem. Ever hear of the story that he created the golem? Perhaps some of you have been to Prague and had a tour guide tell you the story. The Maharal says, just as the sun reigns, so is man a king. For everything is subject to him. Man's royalty expresses itself in that he brings perfection to all earthly creatures, for everything was created in order to serve man and minister to him, etc. What I'm leading towards is Maimonides. Maimonides was the first and one of the few Jewish thinkers who was willing to contemplate a different view of reality. That perhaps man is not the center of all of creation. Perhaps man is not the reason for all of creation. And I'm going to read from Maimonides, and of course the Guide of the Perplexed, just to give you a sense of where we are historically. Maimonides lived in Egypt, and he died in the year 1204. And of course he was the greatest Jewish thinker, philosopher, legalist, leader that ever lived on this planet. So it seems. Says Maimonides the Rambam. Right? Rambam, Maimonides, it's the same person. It is sometimes thought that, according to our opinion, the opinion of the Jews, and our doctrine of production and time of the world as a whole after non-existence, we believe the world was created from nothing. The finality of all, this is what many people think, the finality of all that exists is solely the existence of the human species so that it should worship God. That's what some people think. The purpose of all is for the human species to worship God. And that all that has been made for it alone. It means the human species. So that even the heavenly spheres only revolve in order to be useful to it. It again is the human species. And to bring into existence that which is necessary for it. Some passages in the books of the prophets, if taken according to their external sense, give strong support to this thought. However, if this opinion is carefully examined, as opinions ought to be carefully examined by intelligent men, the flaw in it becomes clear. Necessarily and obligatorily, the argument must end with the answer being given that the final end is God has wished it so. In other words, we cannot be certain that we know the purpose of creation. We can't be certain that God made everything for human beings. Rather, says the Rambam, I'd rather so say, why is it so? Because why is the earth as it is? Why is the universe as it is? Why is the solar system as it is? Because. I'd rather say because than posit a theory that says that God made it all for human beings. It simply is God has wished it so, or his wisdom required this to be so. And this is the correct answer. So Maimonides, it looks like he's saying nothing, but understand the force of his statement. He is questioning and coming out against the certainty that God created this whole universe for man. And he says it's not so simple. You cannot make that statement. For this reason, to my mind, the correct view, according to beliefs of the Torah, a view that corresponds likewise to the speculative views, is as follows. It should not be believed that all the beings exist for the sake of the existence of man. Don't accept that. On the contrary, all the other beings too have been intended for their own sakes. The hippopotamus is for the hippopotamus. And the giraffe is there for the giraffe. And the fly is there for the fly. What does it mean, for itself? It means we cannot see one thing as being there just for something else. You cannot make that statement. You have to say that everything in the world has its own purpose. It's justified in and of itself. It's not just to serve man. And mosquitoes are not created by God just in order to serve as a salve for the wound that's created when a scorpion bites you. It's not just that. Everything has independent value. On the contrary, all the beings too have been intended for their own sakes and not for the sake of something else. Just as he willed that the human species should come to exist, he also has willed that the spheres and the stars should come to exist. This view too has been expressed in the prophetic books, and he brings a proof from Mishlei, from the book of Proverbs. We have done to read it. Next paragraph. If you consider the book which guides all those who seek guidance towards what is correct, and is therefore called the Torah, which means teaching, the notion that we have in view will become manifest to you from the commencement of the account of creation till the end. The book of Genesis, chapter 1, with reference to none of them is the statement made in any way that it exists for the sake of some other thing. He only says, God says, that he brought every part of the world into existence and that its existence conformed to its purpose. This is the meaning of it saying, God saw that it was good. Every day God said it's good. It's good in of itself. It's not just for something else. It's not for the purpose of man necessarily. Hence, be not misled in your soul to think that the spheres, the planets, and the angels have been brought into existence for our sake. For it is explained to us what we are worth. In the book of Isaiah, Yeshayahu, behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket. Like a drop of water, all the nations of the world, Jews and non-Jews, it's just like a drop in the bucket. So why am I bringing this here? Because it looks to me that Maimonides is actually telling us what the end of the book of Job says. And he's actually telling us that it's exactly what the first chapter of Genesis says. God created all. And it's all great, it's all beautiful, it all fits together, but it's not necessarily for my sake. And if I have such a broad view of creation, I don't have to necessarily, when anything happens to me, good or bad, big or small, significant, I don't have to ask the question, why is God doing this to me? The world is so great. Again, I'm not saying this is a satisfying answer, the only answer, but it seems to me that Maimonides is actually helping us to understand the end of the book of Job, even though he doesn't say that. He doesn't mention Job here. Myra, were you about to say something?
It's maybe not that it's our responsibility, right?
That's a very good point. That because one of the main reasons that thinkers other than Maimonides so emphasize that, in their opinion, the world was created for our sake. The reason they say that is because they want to teach us responsibility. Everything is here for you, and if you mess up, you've ruined the whole world. The planets and the stars and the mice and the giraffes and the hippopotamus also, it was all created to serve you so that you could be a good person. If you mess up, you ruined it all. And of course, Maimonides does not want to take away from that sense of responsibility. But he also wants to tell us what he sees as the truth. So it's a dialectic here. On the one hand, we have to know and believe that we are, in some sense, important to God. More important than everything else. To remember that your deeds count. The way you behave from morning to evening is important to God. But on the other hand, you also have to learn that you're not the measure of all things. The hippopotamus is out there also. And don't get bogged down in your self-importance when you stub your toe and ask, why did this happen to me? And even when things worse than stubbing your toe happen, keep a larger perspective. So Maimonides is asking us to be nuanced. Yes, you have to be responsible for the whole world. Your deeds count. But on the other hand, don't let it go to your head. Man's not the measure of all things. And I want to show us now how Maimonides actually codifies this in his book of Halakha, his book of law. We now read philosophy. But reading law, Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, the book of knowledge, the laws of the foundations of the Torah, and this is one of the foundational texts of Halakha, he says, it is a mitzvah to love and revere this glorious and awesome God. As Deuteronomy states, and you shall love the Lord your God. And as Deuteronomy states, revere God your Lord. So there's two different mitzvot, to love, and there's a verse that says you're supposed to love God. To revere God, there's a verse that says you're supposed to revere. Now, the Hebrew word that I translated with revere is yirah, which is not just revere, and it's not just fear, it's a combination. Some translations say it means fear. You should fear God. It doesn't just mean fear, it doesn't just mean revere. It's a combination of reverence that borders on fear. And there's no good English word for it. You have to love, which indicates closeness and understanding and mutuality and partnership. But you also have to revere and step back and retreat in the face of God. Both the approach of love and the distance of awe, fear, and reverence. Both. And then Maimonides says, what is the path to attain love and reverence of him? When a person contemplates his wondrous and great deeds and creations, that's the hippopotamus, right? That's the universe. Contemplate all that God made, and appreciates his infinite wisdom that surpasses all comparison, he will immediately love, praise, and glorify him, yearning with tremendous desire to know God's great name, as David stated, King David, in the Psalms, my soul thirsts for the Lord, for the living God. When he continues to reflect in these same matters, and you go to the planetarium, and you see the universe, and you read National Geographic, and you just are overwhelmed and blown away by the grandeur of creation, yes, you do come to love it all, but he will immediately recoil in awe and fear, appreciating how is a tiny, lowly, and dark creature standing with his flimsy, limited wisdom before he, who is of perfect knowledge. As King David stated, when I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, I wonder, what is man that you should be mindful of him? And to me, it's the end of the book of Job, what Maimonides is doing to us. He's telling us that part of your consciousness has to be that I am nothing compared to the great universe. That's exactly what God tells Job out of the whirlwind at the end of the book. And it takes Maimonides to translate that into rules for living your life. Right? So to me, that's really, really powerful. But I want to go back to Myra's point, right? This sense of lowliness. You looking for someone?
Is there immediate noon here? For
perhaps, I don't know.
Oh, you're so sorry. I'll
be yet.
Sorry.
But Myra's point is always well taken, that as much as we want to appreciate what God says at the end of the book of Job, and Maimonides says here, that we're really nothing, that cannot become a source for a sense of meaninglessness, that my deeds are not meaningful. We have here a balance. My deeds are meaningful, and God wants us to do the right thing. But at the same time, there has to be this global, grand perspective, and it's a balance. So,
do I? Until we get it right, Messiah won't come. Right?
It's always a balance, yeah. And the way I want to end, and we're going to go, I guess, 4 minutes overtime. I hope that's okay. We started 5 minutes, 6 minutes late. I want to mention something that I thought of last week during class, and I made a 5-second reference to. And that is a famous letter that was written by Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Kuk in about the year 1904, I think. It's certainly the first decade of the 20th century. Rav Kuk wrote this letter to a young man who was confused concerning the relationship between religion and science, something we're still struggling with today. And within this letter, Rav Kuk says things that are so relevant to what we're saying right now and so relevant to Myra's point. So let's read it. The crux of the matter, do you see the place where I am?
Mm-hmm.
The crux of the matter is, that the time of the appearance and the effects of every idea and thought is predetermined. As Rav Kook believes there, that everything that happens in this world is not predetermined in the negative sense you might think. It's part of God's plan. I probably shouldn't have used predetermined in the translation. Everything is planned by God. That might be a better translation. Nothing is haphazard. For example, we can understand that if the fact of the globe's movement was made known to the masses a few thousand years ago and would have feared to stand on his feet lest he fall from the force of the earth's movement, all the more so would he have feared building tall buildings. Rav Kook says, today we know the earth revolves. 5,000 years ago, it's a good thing people didn't know that, because they would have afraid to stand up. They'd say, I might fall off. They certainly wouldn't have built tall buildings. And Rav Kook is saying that God allowed science to discover the fact that the world revolves only when we were ready to hear that. A general faint-heartedness and incalculable thought of development would have resulted if human beings learned the fact of the Earth's revolution too early in human history. The notion of the gravitational force would not have assured him, having seen with his own eyes that anything standing on a moving object cannot be secured from falling. Only after mankind matured through experience was it proper to allow men to recognize the Earth's movement so that from it only good would come to man. And now it's important for us. This idea applies to spirituality as well. It was necessary for the people of Israel to work long and hard against the various pagan sects to make them understand that despite the vastness of the universe, man is not so inconsequential that his adherence to moral directives is without value. And that the creation of man as a moral being is of great significance, incalculably greater than even the quantitatively largest creations. What Rav Kook is claiming, that in the ancient world of idolatry, there was a sense of the inconsequentiality of man. We're nothing. And therefore, our deeds don't matter. And therefore, there's no absolute morality. If I'm just like a fly in a giraffe, I can do whatever I want. God doesn't care. It doesn't matter. There's no absolute morality. And Rav Kook claims that the Torah originally taught that man is the center of everything in order to teach what Myra said, responsibility, that God cares about what you do, and you have a responsibility to do the right thing. And that was part of Judaism's fight against paganism. Paganism that says there's many gods, they all have their own agenda, there's no one right and wrong way. The Torah says there's one God with one agenda, and he's looking right at you at every moment. He's you're the only thing he cares about. You're the center of the universe, man, and you better get it right. That was the Torah's message. So what would have happened if the myriad worlds of this present state of science were then known? He claims that God purposely made it that science was not so advanced then, because had we known about the planets and the planets and the solar systems, we could not have maintained the sense of the importance of human deeds. We just say we're just a speck of dust, and a speck of dust, and a speck of dust, and it doesn't mean anything. God didn't let us discover all of those worlds and solar systems and Milky Ways. It would have undermined morality. Man would have been like a speck in his morality of no consequence, and it would have been impossible to foster within him a spirit of greatness and universal glory, and he means responsibility. Only now, in the modern era, after man's emergence from his struggle with an image of a world of overwhelming immensity, is he truly no longer frightened by the vastness of creation. But all this required time and preparation. In other words, only after Judaism firmly taught us responsibility and that indeed our deeds are important, then we can go and expand our horizons and understand that really there's a lot more out there than human beings. So it's all about balance. Much of Judaism taught us that man is central to God. And then comes the book of Job and balances us out. that man is not the measure of all things. And next week we'll finish the book of Job. Okay.
Good. How about you? You have a few minutes.